This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register to attend PASA's 31st annual conference by January 28th at pasafarming.org/conference.
You're listening to Season 2 of Fields, the podcast, with Melissa Metrick, Wythe Marshall, and Allie Wist.
On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working in the world of urban agriculture. For money, for fun, for art, for justice, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or to uncover its history.
In each episode of Fields, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in cities, one technology used to grow food, or one project that teaches us something about our relationship to farming in urban environments.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer today.
You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast, or even a foodie.
We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements, examining each in turn. Thank you so much for listening. Hey there, you're listening to Fields, and we're speaking to Monica Goya, the author of Urban Farmers, The Now and How of Growing Food in the City. It's a new book out from Gestalten Press.
We were really intrigued by this book that explores inner city agriculture, you know, everything from underground mushroom farms to rooftop beekeeping. And we're excited to ask, you know, Monica a little more about the book that, it covers urban farming, but it's also positioned as a kind of manual for city dwellers who dream of having a more agrarian or just greener life. And we, with opportunities for average city folk to, you know, learn best practices from experts and ways to get your hands dirty, as it says in the book. So, Monica, first, if you could just introduce yourself and what led you to this project.
I'm a journalist and photographer, and Valerie, who is the co-editor and photographer of the book, and I met because of our mutual interest in urban agriculture. So we became friends despite living in different continents, because she is from New York. And through the years, we mentioned often, like, it would be so great to do a project together.
I'm curious a little bit about your interest in urban agriculture and urban gardening, and if you have any experience.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a rural area in northern Spain. And when I moved to London, I really miss, not at first, but after a while, I really miss being in touch with nature. And so I started covering urban agriculture from there. Places like Growing Underground, which is a farm located in the tube tunnels, like, I don't know how many meters underground, and they grow fresh herbs and microgreens. I've also done beekeeping, and so in a way it felt like a way to be, to feel closer to home while also discovering the amazing things that London have, because for me it was quite shocking to see, like, beekeeping for me was something that it was always attached to the countryside, and it was quite surprising to see it in a city.
Yeah, I love, even right in the intro of your book, I'll just read a few sentences. You know, imagine that it's a sun-dappled summer morning, the air smells of rosemary and dirt, and there are chickens and ducks. Behind them, skyscrapers cast their shadows over this little green haven in the middle of the city. And I just love that scene setting, kind of the contrast of the urban setting with this kind of agrarian sensibility you cover in the book. And I guess I'd ask, what are the kind of unique opportunities that are presented to urban farmers or urban beekeepers over rural farmers? What did you find was kind of actually advantageous about growing in the city?
I think one of the most interesting opportunities for urban farmers is the access that they have to the final consumer. So the chance to go beyond growing food because most urban farmers I talked to over the years mentioned that urban agriculture cannot feed entire cities. It's like it's not possible and it shouldn't even try. However, they can do many other initiatives like workshops or guided tours that can introduce city people to farming and creating a sort of bond. And like it's true that some rural farmers do farmers markets in the city, and so they can talk to their customers, but it's like a once a week thing, and it's not the same buying produce from them. It's quite different to visit the farm, to see how the plants grow, like from seed to then flower to then fruit. I feel in that context, there is more room to discuss vital topics like sustainability, soil health, biodiversity. And for example, biodiversity can take many shapes. There is a company called True Love Seeds, which is mentioned in the book, and they basically protect seeds from disappearing. Some of them are culturally significant crops for different communities, because often we think about animals going extinct, but we don't think about crops. So that's something else that can be done. And also, depending on the farm's mission, farms could also support food security, like East New York farms do at their Pink Houses farm. So I mean, there are many different ways when urban farms have a chance to make a difference.
Yeah, great. It sounds sort of educational, experiential, beyond just the physical production of fruits and vegetables.
Monica, I really find it amazing all of the farms that you have covered, and also the in-depth aspect of the farms that you covered. I teach about urban agriculture, and I'm very fond of True Love Seeds and the work that Owen does, and also just a lot of the New York farms that you cover in general, the farms in New York City and things like that. So I just kind of found it great, kind of this deep dive that you did, especially you know, not only talking about these urban farms, but talking about, you know, that seed company or seed saving and biodiversity in that aspect. So I just kind of wanted to jump in and talk kind of talk about that a little bit. I found that was really great about the book.
It's true. I think the biodiversity aspect is really interesting, that these urban farms bring an important attention to the variety of seeds that other people wouldn't see, or just a diversity of, or perhaps an insight into growing that people don't know about. And I think one of the best examples of that in the book was the saffron farm. You know, saffron is the most expensive spice in the world, and it's so labor intensive. I think in the book you say it takes 150 grams of the flower to just produce 1 gram of saffron. And I think it was really interesting to see that cited in Paris, in a city, this really labor intensive, really fragile process that most people would never otherwise witness. I'm kind of curious what your experience was visiting that farm and what it was like to, or what the farmers had to say about growing something that luxurious and tedious, kind of on top of a multi-story building in the middle of a city.
Yeah, well, I couldn't actually. That's one of the farms I couldn't visit because we work on the book during the pandemic. There were travel restrictions, and quite a few farms I had visited before, but this one I didn't. But talking to them, it's interesting how people end up doing things. I mean, without a plan. She said that because she saw that she had some saffron bulbs in her windowsill, and she saw that they were thriving as opposed to the ones at her parents' house in the countryside. And she started thinking, oh, maybe this could be something that we could grow here. Urban farmers have the problem of space, which is very limited. and therefore they have to grow crops that are maybe not expensive, but they can make a profit off from, because otherwise how can they survive? Last harvest, I think she said they had something like 700 grams and they are aiming to get 1 kilo. So it's not, even if it's expensive, the amount of saffron that they harvest is not, it's not big either.
Yeah, wow. It's really interesting that the sort of high end or luxuriness of the spice itself is kind of important aspect when you're dealing with such space constraints. You do need something that is incredibly valuable, or at least it helps.
In my opinion, I think it's quite unique to have this kind of crop that is also very, is also close to other food cultures like Iran or Spain. To have the chance to have it in the middle of Paris is quite unique. And it's only, I think the harvest lasts only like 2 or 3 weeks in the early autumn, but people can witness the process, which is very intense and delicate.
I'm also wondering, because that it could only be harvested in the fall, like saffron is actually a crocus. So it's a bulb, and usually crocuses come out in the spring and things like that. So I wonder if that also adds to why it's so expensive and kind of this luxurious thing, because it could only be harvested in the fall. And so there's such a limited amount of time that you could actually get it.
They did mention that you need to go and visit every day, because you need to go on the exact day that the flower opens. Otherwise, it's done. So it's really, you need to be on top of things to make sure that it works.
Sort of probably like the beekeepers you visited as well. I mean, that's a really intimate, attention requiring, type of engagement. And I think you note in the book that, you know, beekeeping, participating in a hive of bees, is kind of becoming entangled in a whole food web and being so connected to so many other organisms in the city. And we're just curious if you can talk a little more about what you learned about urban beekeeping and the folks you met doing that.
I have to admit that I was very surprised. As I mentioned before, the first time I was in touch with a beekeeper in the city, because to me that had been something that, you know, my grandmother in a rural town, very isolated, did, and in the city was like, what? But I feel in terms of values, like beekeeping is like every living creature depends on each other somehow for survival. And bees are a symbol of that dependency or reliance. Like, they provide vital pollination services for free. And then we need to provide them with flowers or trees for them to feed on them, to then create the honey. So I feel that bees also, once you are involved in beekeeping, they make you see the city with a different lens, because suddenly you start looking at how many flowers there are, how many trees, you know, what the in which season the flowers bloom, because bees work all through the warmer months. So they need flowers to bloom from, I don't know, spring till late summer. So, yeah, I think it's a sort of a whole new different world that opens up for you when you become to, when you start to observe and nature in general. And bees are such fascinating animals that, it's incredible.
Yeah, they really are. I believe the guest essay mentions the bees themselves are sort of like a super organism. So thinking about being able to participate in the super organism of a beehive. And also for city dwellers, we often feel like we're part of a super organism of the city too. So it's kind of related.
Yeah, I think one thing that I would like to point out, because every urban beekeeper I've talked to always says this, is that it's really important for people who want to begin beekeeping to make sure that there is enough food for the bees, because with the rise of beekeeping, now in the city it's harder and harder for bees to find food, depending on where. So that's the one basic tip that they all, is one of the rare occasions where they all say the same thing in New York, in London, everywhere.
And so what is their recommendation for the average urban gardener, city dweller to help increase what bees need to stay healthy or just increase the kind of urban agriculture landscape?
I think planting pollinator-friendly crops can help, even if you have just a windowsill space, something tiny, it is better than nothing. And also trees, I mean, I didn't realize when I started on this, but trees are so important. You tend to, at least in my case, I tended to think of flowers, and trees can make a better work than flowers when they are in bloom, because Tim from Wilk Apiary, he said that, I believe he said 500,000 flowers. A tree could provide 500,000 flowers when it's in bloom. I'm not sure about the, but I think it was 500,000. And that's incredible.
Yeah, Monica, that's totally, yeah, I've heard that too, that a lot of urban bees, actually, and bees in general, get their food from trees. So maybe also the idea of us focusing on our street trees in urban areas and like, are they, what kind of flowers are they, you know, producing? Are they friendly to our, not only our honeybees, but our native bees and things like that. So that's a, yeah, really great mm-hmm. kind of aspect.
Yeah. Cause my first thought was, oh, what could we recommend people plant in their own garden, you know, tomatoes and squash. And now I'm realizing, well, part of that is also making sure you plant plants for the other non-humans that are part of this system. It's not just for you to eat. You need to plant things for them to eat too.
Yeah. And then in the long run, they'll help us eat because the bees will pollinate our tomatoes and like everything else. Right. So.
Yeah, it's a really funny thing about New York's history because they chopped down all the trees and then at various points have had to bring back trees. And so there's lots of trees today, comparatively. There are cities that are a lot worse. But like at the end of the 19th century, I believe there were sort of no trees, and the progressives, it was like basically rich people who were like missing verdancy, like just green stuff. And then over the 20th century, it's like, wait, trees fall on cars. But also trees produce fruit, but also trees produce smells, but also you need trees for like birds and pollinators. And so like urban planning had to sort of bring trees back in after initially just being like nature, just kill all of that. And I think the beekeeping is such a great example that's like on trend of, you know, yeah, the idea of those intimate relationships. And you can't just do one thing, you know, you can't just have bees because you do need the trees that the bees need. And luckily they rhyme, so it's fun to say. But it really is like, it's a policy issue. You know, it's great to like plant stuff in your own yard. And it's also really important to like push policymakers on like green infrastructure that's forward looking. I don't know. That's something I always want to ask about, Monica, like your thoughts on in your research, how urban agriculture relates to other aspects of sort of city planning and like the future of just dwelling in cities.
I really don't have data to back this affirmation, but I feel that people are more interested in urban agriculture than ever before, people in cities. And so I hope that city planners and people who do urbanism, hopefully they will consider this when they are planning changes in cities or when they are planning new places. And I think through the book and the research, one of the best examples I found on how policy can really help change things and back projects is in Paris. And they have this program which is called Paris Cultures, and they promote the development of urban agriculture projects through the city. And the aim is to have 100 hectares at some point. And it started in 2016. And quite a few of the projects on the book are part of, are sort of graduates from this program, like the Saffron Sisters, or there is also an organic flower farm. There is the farm, the edible gardens on top of the Opera Bastille, which is called Top Ailleurs, and they also come from this program. And so it's great. I think it's a great example, not only for what they are achieving, because they are actually making Paris much greener, but it's also a great initiative to promote biodiversity and make agriculture more present in the lives of Parisians while creating jobs, starting a conversation on healthy eating, and, you know, making companies, the local authorities and the communities working, they are all working together towards the same goal. And I think that's how the future, I feel that by involving as many people as possible, not only from a policy level, but also from like citizen level, companies, startups, they are achieving amazing things. It started in 2016. It's been 5 years, and you can see it's tangible. Like, you go to Paris and you see that there are rooftops, that there are vacant lots where there are things going on.
Yeah, it really requires the commitment from politicians and from urban planners and policymakers to actually see these projects through, I think, in a lot of ways.
And also giving access to that land to urban growers, right? Like, the possibility of, instead of developing that land, putting it aside or protecting that land or giving grants and funds and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a matter of really valuing this. These projects, when it comes to capital and capitalism and one, you know, hectare of land, you can imagine the real estate value, right? And so it requires weighting the other side of that equation and weighting the value of beekeeping and urban agriculture enough culturally for us to tip the scales and find the money and save that land for that. So I guess it's a call to everyone individually in their own cities to tell their elected officials it's something they care about.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. For 30 years, PASA's conference has served as a springboard for transformative food system change. PASA's 2022 conference features more than 30 virtual and 90 in-person sessions on farming and food systems, covering topics that include building community food webs, keeping seeds to preserve cultural traditions, protecting local watersheds, as well as production methods and business skills for food producers of all levels. Keynote speakers include Soulfire Farms' Leah Penniman, author of Farming While Black, Sarah Mock, author of Farm and Other F-Words, and Jessica Gordon Nemhard, author of Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. PASA's virtual pre-conference takes place January 4th through 28th. Register anytime to attend live or get recordings. You can also join PASA in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on February 10th through 12th for its in-person main conference. Comprehensive COVID safety measures will be in place. Learn more and register at pasafarming.org/conference. That's PASA farming.org/conference.
I wanted to ask a question. You kind of, or it's mentioned in the beginning of the book about the idea of the popularity of urban agriculture and how it's become more popular in the last couple of years, especially during the pandemic, because everybody was at home. There was the fear of food shortages, that type of thing. And it's mentioned in the book that, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of attention has been put towards urban agriculture. And the question is asked, will that attention last, right? And that's like the ongoing urban agriculture question of like, okay, it's becoming really popular. Like, what will happen in 5 years and 10 years and things like that. So in doing these case studies, of many of these urban farmers all over the world. Have you come about a certain answer? I know that's a little bit hard to say because, like, who knows? But through speaking to these urban farmers, what did you get the feeling of? Like, just from speaking to these companies or speaking to nonprofits or speaking to educational gardens and farms, what was the feel that you got? Did you actually get to kind of answer that question for at least yourself at the end?
As you say, who knows, right, what's going to happen? But I could really feel the energy. Like, people were really convinced, and most people who work in that field do it by conviction. Like, they really truly believe in what they are doing. They really think that is important. And there are so many ways of making it work. That's what we talk about in a previous question. Like, urban farmers don't only grow food. They can have a relevant role, like, I don't know, teaching children about nature. In the next few decades, quite a lot of new people will come to cities, according to the UN field. I think it's almost 70% of people will be living in urban areas in 20 years. So there are children who might not know or who might not have never seen a cow or, you know, a plant in growing. So I think it's going to be, I don't know if it will be part of the school curriculum but there are so many ways of making it something that is going to last, that is going to be part of the cities of the future, because it has to be. I mean, considering the climate crisis, considering the world we are living in, it feels as part of the solution. Not in feeding entire cities, but in educating people and giving them an excuse to be closer to nature. Because when you know, like everything, I feel when you know something, you respect something, someone, you respect that more. So if you have seen a plant growing, you might then consider who is behind this lettuce that I'm buying at the supermarket, who has done the hard work, which might have consequences for different sort of policy regarding immigration, workers' rights. It has so many branches that it can touch, from just that simple gesture of taking a child to a farm and showing him. So yeah, I hope that's the future.
Yeah, I really do think it's important to consider, like you said, urban agriculture as part of a sort of conceptual movement we need to make too, to understand some of these systems. And it seems like it kind of relates to the role of urban food and agriculture movements in history in cities that were also partially about education and about politics and not just about growing food. You know, I think of the Black Panthers or the Green Guerrilla movement.
I think there probably hasn't been enough recognition when you look back at history of people who have always grown food. If you look back, many of the people who used to grow food in cities did it because of necessity, whereas now it feels more like a lifestyle thing.
I think you're right in that we haven't always recognized these projects as significant as they have been in the past. And now we're in a moment where it's in this weird zone of being in some ways aspirational and lifestyle for individual gardeners and for folks who are trying to incorporate more urban agriculture, pollinator friendly plants into their own yard. But there are also people who are trying larger scale agriculture in cities, and maybe, Wythe, was that your question you wanted to expand on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's an assumption either way that, like, urban agriculture could be scaled up to feed lots of people, at least certain kinds of plants, like certain nutrients, or that it can't, and that it's purely a matter of, like, hobbyism and lifestyle. And I think clearly there's people who are trying to scale it up to meet a lot of nutritional needs when it comes to at least, like, leafy greens and vining crops, and maybe, like,
you know, fish you could imagine for a lot of coastal cities, or an indoor, you know, recirculating aquaponics or something. So I think it is a question of like how much food could or should be grown in cities that different cities have talked about, most probably prominently recently Singapore, saying they're going to try to be 30% food sovereign as a city state, right? They're going to grow 30% of their food on their territory. And Singapore is slightly smaller than New York City, for example. So that's like a question that's come up here is like, well, wait, if they can do 30%, could we do even 2%? Or like, what would that mean? 2% of certain crops, or like, how much was it a matter? Like, what are the barriers? Is it a matter of investment? Is it land? Like, you know, what does that even mean to sort of wrap your head around? But I think it does raise that question of like, is urban agriculture just a sort of lifestyle, you know, hobby? Or is it, I mean, I think it's probably a range of things. And I think there's probably a lifestyle component today, but I'm curious about people who are trying to make that professional shift. And if you, I mean, you talk to a range of people as we have, and if you've noticed different, you know, aspects of the move to be an urban farmer, I don't know, maybe Melissa, do you have anything to add here as a pro?
Yeah, actually I've been like holding back, but I mean, kind of the interesting historical context, a lot of times is people become interested in urban agriculture during times of crisis, right? Mm-hmm. And also there's a lot of political support and funding and things like that, specifically in the US from the federal government, you know, during the time of the Great Depression, during the World Wars. You know, in the 1970s, urban agriculture became really popular because, you know, for example, New York City almost went bankrupt, but, you know, that was practiced more by, the people of color who were still left in the city, because they didn't have, because of redlining and things like that. So, you know, I think also a larger question is, you know, the attention to urban agriculture, but also, with the times of crisis or things like that, like we're going through a pandemic, but Monica, kind of like what you mentioned, these larger, you know, long-term things like climate change, like we're still going to be going through these things. And with the fear of, you know, food shortages or whatever, are people going to be more drawn to it? Or through, you know, the also other aspect that you said, in kind of as one of the like solutions to climate change, or not solutions, but could at least kind of help with climate change, is if you're growing more, you know, just more greenery in cities in general because of heat island effect and all these other things. So yeah, just the interesting aspect of historical context and when urban agriculture is popular, and also the attention of, you know, just everyday folks and, yeah, you know, when they're interested in it and when they're going to actually do it and spend the time doing it, right? Yeah. Like they put their busy, some time in their busy urban lives aside to practice urban agriculture. So sorry, that was me ranting, but.
A German friend of mine told me that until a few years ago, it was basically the opposite of fashionable to have an allotment in German cities. It was a matter of like pensioners, you know, like older people. And now there is like a 5-year waiting list, and it's all younger people who are very interested in nature and environment. And I feel, yes, there must be a life aspect to it, but there is also an interest, because if it's only a lifestyle aspect to it, you get tired, like, it's hard work. After a few days, you probably just would give up in many ways. I mean, so I think you need a real interest to keep doing it, because it requires dedication.
Maybe it starts as a kind of aspirational and lifestyle engagement. And then there really is kind of a larger commitment, but you become in relationship both with the plants, maybe with your neighbors, and like with this larger community. But yeah, it certainly requires a commitment beyond, you know, something purely hobbyist, if you're really going to make it work.
In that sense of folks who are, you know, getting into urban agriculture or growing in cities, what are some how-tos or takeaways for apartment dwellers trying to garden more on their fire escapes or balconies? Did you kind of Would you suggest any of those from all of the different people that you interviewed, Monica?
Well, probably the most important is to start, to just go for it. And also, I think starting with something easy, like herbs, for example, basil grows fast. So that could be a good one to keep you motivated. In the book, there is a sort of guide to grow food in small spaces. And I think one of the most important things is to consider the space.
Monica, do you want to plug the book and how we should find it and explore it online?
So the title of the book is Urban Farmers, and the book is out in the US on the 13th of July. In Europe, it's already out. And you can find it in bookshops or online places like bookshop.org.
Great. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and hearing about your adventure in covering both urban farms in person and remotely during a pandemic. And the book itself is beautiful, photography as well. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to our brilliant guests. Fields theme music is by Sam Tyndall. Our amazing producing engineer at Heritage Radio is Liam Werner.
Fields is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at Heritage_radio and at Fields Podcast.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you.
Want to be a part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.